In Deuteronomy 28, verses 1 through 14, are the blessings of obedience. And they're rather wonderful, to say the least. It shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and to do all his commandments, which I command thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come on thee, and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God. Blessed shalt thou be in the city, and blessed shalt thou be in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of thy body, and the fruit of thy ground, and the fruit of thy cattle, and the increase of thy kine, and the flocks of thy sheep. Blessed shall be thy basket and thy store. Blessed shalt thou be when thou comest in, and blessed shalt thou be when thou goest out. The Lord shall cause thine enemies that rise up against thee to be smitten before your face. They shall come out against thee one way, and shall flee before thee seven ways. The Lord shall command the blessing upon thee in thy storehouses, and in all that thou settest thine hand unto to do. And he shall bless thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. The Lord shall establish thee a holy people unto himself, as he has sworn unto thee, if thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord thy God, and walk in his ways. And all the people of the earth shall see that thou art called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of thee. And the Lord shall make thee plenteous in goods, and the fruit of thy body, and the fruit of thy cattle, and the fruit of thy ground, in the land which the Lord sware unto thy fathers to give thee. The Lord shall open unto thee his good treasure, the heaven, to give you rain unto the land in his season, and to bless all the work of thine hand. Thou shalt lend unto many nations, and shall never again borrow. The Lord shall make thee the head, and no longer the tail. And thou shalt be above only, thou shalt not be beneath. If that thou hearken unto the commandment of the Lord thy God, which I command thee this day to observe and to do, and thou shalt not go aside from the words which I command thee this day, to the right hand or to the left, to go after other gods to serve them. But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Cursed shall thou be in the city, cursed shall thou be in the field. Cursed shall be the basket of thy store, cursed shall be the fruit of thy body and the fruit of thy land, and the increase of thy kine and the flocks of thy sheep. Cursed thou shall be when thou comest in, and cursed shall thou be when thou goest out. The Lord shall send upon thee cursing, vexation, and rebuke, in all that thou settest thine hand unto for to do, until you be destroyed, and until you perish quickly, because of the wickedness of thy doings, whereby thou hast forsaken me. It goes on with some rather interesting curses. It goes on through the rest of chapter 28, which is a long chapter. There's 68 verses. There was 14 verses of blessing, and 54 verses of cursing. Now, the question is, how do you do and observe his commandments? There's only one way, and that is to bring every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Now, chapter 29 of Deuteronomy is Moses exhorting to obedience. He said, the Lord hath not given you up to this day heart to perceive, or eyes to see, or ears to hear, but he's been leading you through the wilderness. You see, I fully believe that which I've said so often, that the world and all the ways of the world are Egypt. Coming out of the world, until you hear the law, you're a child, an infant. At the hearing of the law, you become an adolescent. And at the point of overcoming the evil one, you enter the promise. And then at the point of the fall of Jericho, or possibly the entrance to Jerusalem, you become the father. Now, so the process of observance and the process of exhortation is different if you're in the world, or in the wilderness before the law, or in the wilderness after the law, or in the promised land before Jericho or Jerusalem, or if you're truly settled in the New Jerusalem. And that's what he means when he writes to the child, the adolescent, the young man, and the father. But the distance between Egypt and the father position is the snap of a finger. It's not time, it's obedience. Now, obedience, this is a biggie, and you better bet your life either that I'm right or wrong on it, because that's what you're doing. If obedience means to hear under any circumstance that you find yourself in, then there's a chance. If obedience means to do what religion and what your mind says obedience means, then we are without hope. If I have been wrong all these years in telling you that as he is in the world, so are we, and that before you're under the before the law, you are as a child, and at the hearing of the law, or at some point soon thereafter, you go from the adolescent to the young man because you've overcome the evil one. If all of that isn't right, then you're in big trouble. And so it's at the point of this casting down imaginations that the crux of our whole life as a believer our life as a believer hangs on this point, because you've gone too far to ever again return to the idea of the shoulds and shouldn'ts of Christianity. None of you can ever accept that again. I can't imagine any of you ever accepting that again. So if this point is not right, you're in deep shit.
That obedience means to hear under.
And what casting down of imaginations means.
What is hear under?
To hear the word of the Lord under whatever condition you're in. Not to be out of sorts or not to be upset, not to be weirded out right. By the stimulus that confronts you.
Amen. Circumstances.
You're no longer weirded out by circumstances, but no matter what the circumstances are, you still are able to hear because your ears have been circumcised. Mm. Now, the casting down of imaginations becomes the central point. Forget everything we have ever... Forget every point you have ever been along the pathway. Forget the hot seat, forget groves, forget... forget it all. Neglect it. Now everything hangs on casting down of imaginations. You understand?
Mm-hmm. Because there's imaginations that keep you from hearing under.
Right now it is.
Yeah.
It wasn't before. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. Now we've passed that point. From now on, the only thing that keeps you from full sanctification is your imaginations. And the only thing that keeps you from casting down imaginations is not seeing correctly. The only thing that will keep you from casting down of imaginations is to continue in the original lie that you are separate from God, therefore walk in fear, therefore think you have to make plans and devices to enter or to satisfy some objective. What'd you get? Oh, it's here. Never mind. See, that's
a good illustration.
That's the first time I've really seen the implications of being separate from God. I mean, if you think you're separate, then you're automatically...
If you think you're separate...
If you're not separate, how can you need anything? I mean,
right. Hear this clearly. If you think... all fear is sin, and sin will keep you from the kingdom of God. All fear is based on the fact that you believe you need to control. All need to control is based on the fact that you believe you are separate from the Father of Spirits. So the anchor of everything that I'm going to talk about for the next who knows how long is this idea that you are not separate. You never have been separate, and if your mind continues to, if you permit your mind or your soul to continue to act as it's separate, then you're in deep trouble. I'm going to read a scripture. Moses is exhorting in chapter 29 of Deuteronomy. He's exhorting to pay attention to what he just said. The incredible blessings, the extreme danger of the cursings, and now he's exhorting to pay attention. And he said, and he's exhorting. And then he says, starting in verse 10, he said, "You stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God. You don't know it, because your eyes and your senses have not been fully exercised." There's a portion of you that is still operating after the senses and after the seeing of the flesh. But you are standing this day before the Lord your God, as sure as you will be on the last day. Your captains of your tribes, your elders, your officers, with all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and the stranger that is in thy camp, from the hewer of thy wood unto the drawer of thy water, that thou shouldest enter into covenant with the Lord thy God, and into his oath, which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day. That he may, and again, it's not strong enough here, but here it says that he may establish. In Hebrew it says that he may establish with finality, once and for all time. That he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, never again to be separate. Never again believing the lie of the beast that's been resurrected from the dead. Never again allowing this thing called your mind to act as though it were separate. Never again, therefore, to operate in the vanity of your mind. Okay. That he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, that he may be unto thee a God, as he has said unto thee, and as he has sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And he goes on and talks some more. And he comes up to this incredible statement. In verse 16, "For you know how we have dwelt in the land of Egypt, and how we came through the nations which we passed by, and you have seen their abominations and their idols and wood and stone and silver and gold which were among them. Now I've told you before so often that the images by which you have in here
even to the extent of definition of words. Those are graven images that you no longer have to give importance to. Your importance and your life for the next second comes only from the Father, not on your ability to compute it in your mind, not on your ability to apprehend it, not in some terrible striving where you're exercising yourself in things too high for you, not in this headlong drive to accomplish some little plan or scheme or device that is meaningless in the scheme of God, but this moment. You don't have to pay any attention. They're there. You don't have to pay attention to them anymore. But he goes on to say, you have seen all these abominations. Some of you have seen them a lot clearer than others, because some of you have a lot bigger ones. Bigger idols, bigger abominations. The bigger your abomination, the greater success you can be in the world. But it's really sick, is if you don't have any, you then strive after somebody else's abominations. You trust in oppression, by the way. We didn't talk about this in this group. To trust in oppression means your ability to control someone else or someone else's ability to control you.
Is that here?
Okay. Verse 18, lest there should be among you man, woman, or family or tribe, whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God, to go and serve the gods of these nations. Lest there should be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood. The root of bitterness that's talked about in Hebrews. And it come to pass, when he heareth the words of this curse, that he bless or congratulate himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination of my heart. To add drunkenness to thirst.
Well, since nobody really says it in those words, what are they really saying?
He just said
it. Read again. For you know how we have dwelt in the land of Egypt, and how we came through the nations which you passed by, and you have seen their abominations. You've seen them all. All of you have seen it. Through the preaching of the cross, there's not one of you that can have an idol within you that you can justify. If there is, I challenge you. Agag will have arrived. And we'll slice him up into little pieces once more. Now, you've seen the abominations through the nations which you passed by, and you have seen their abominations and their idols, wood and stone, silver and gold, which were among them. Now, lest there be among you man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of these nations, lest there should be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood. Do you understand what they just said? I don't think you do. The root is the serving of those idols. That root is defined as gall and wormwood. Now, if there is that root in any of you, then it's time that it be spoken. To go and serve those idols whose name, the root's name, is gall and wormwood. Now, and it come to pass, any, if that's in you, here's what will happen. It will come to pass that you will hear the words of the curse, and that you will, but you will bless yourself in your heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination of my heart, to add drunkenness to thirst. It's the same as Isaiah 57, where he said, let me read it, Isaiah 57, verse 10. Thou art wearied in the greatness of thy way, yet saidest thou not, there is no hope. For thou hast found the life of thy hand, and therefore thou wast not grieved. Understand? Now we're going to talk tonight for the rest of a while about what it means to add drunkenness to thirst. Thirst is the process by which you
need wine.
No, it's more than you need wine, but you thirst after that which can only be satisfied by the wine. Therefore, you thirst after approval, you thirst after, you know, all of these kinds of things. But to add drunkenness to the thirst means that you've taken the wrong wine to satisfy the thirst. You've taken the wine of Ephraim instead of the wine of Passover. Now the wine of Ephraim, and read it in Isaiah 28, is simply another way of saying the wine or the process of egocentricity, of being ego-centered in your life. And it doesn't matter whether it's an ego-centered positive or negative. It's both the wine of Ephraim or the pride of Ephraim, and therefore because I am the subject of the sentence and the thought. Now, I'm going to ask you all to do something. This is something that Harry and I and some of you, we've talked about the possibility of doing this. But I'm going to ask you to do an exercise for the next couple days until we meet again on Tuesday. Every time you begin to think or speak and use the personal pronoun, either I or mine, or my, or any of its related, that you would see it. In the real sense, the process of casting down imaginations is simply the process of changing I or mine to his. Am I communicating at all?
Yeah.
Now I want you to try. Did you catch it? I want you to try.
That's what I was thinking. It'd be enough. Be enough. Just no. Just to hear yourself every time you,
you say
the word.
You say I.
Just to hear that. You wouldn't have to think in your mind. You'd be saying I enough.
But what are we seeing from, like you said, you just did it. What is that sin?
Well, I did it on purpose. Yes, it's sin.
I meant to do that.
Who meant to?
Me. But what is the purpose? That's what I want to do.
I, whenever you use I, you in effect are, maybe there's some examples that are not this, but you in effect are declaring your separateness and you're revealing the double-mindedness. I don't care whether it's with regard to a problem or with regard to a desire. I look like I'm talking to a bunch of...
Sounds right.
I say, excuse me.
Yeah, just to see that we're one. We're not our own selves. So every time we say I, without that consciousness of unity, which will be hate almost every time.
And it's real obvious with the possessive pronoun.
Yeah. So we would never say I if separateness was...
Well, the most you would say would be I and the Father are one.
Yes.
I and the Father are one. You never say I separate from the Father. If you read...
In your understanding.
In your understanding.
Like we're going to quit using the word I. Or
yeah.
But from now until Tuesday, be aware that every time you use the personal pronoun... Do all of you know what a personal pronoun is?
Yes.
I,
me,
plural.
Your mother.
First person, personal pronoun.
It's my own personal pronoun.
It's my own personal pronoun.
But whenever you use I, or mine, or me, whether it's positive or negative, whether it's, oh, I'm really feeling, oh, whatever it is, oh, I wish this, oh. In your thought process or in your speech process, you are simply revealing your innate belief that you are separate from the Father. And therefore, you are not casting down imaginations. Do you understand a little bit?
Yeah.
See, we don't understand the pervasiveness of the evil. The whole world is in deception. And by His grace, we have been translated out of that kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of His dear Son.
Is it like the same thing to say, you, this, that, and the other, you did something, you use somebody else's personal
accusations
pronoun.
Always said, you said in your mind, you use the I, like if you're accusing.
You did it to me.
You know, the I is implied in your stuff.
Yeah.
Well, they're also accusing.
But you know, it's like, it's not just the word I, it's the whole concept of I comes up to
I-ness.
See.
I-ness.
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 Selfness.
I've talked to you about this before, but some of you may not remember that governmental systems are based on language. And in Chinese or in Russian, you cannot say, or it's not said normally, that these are my glasses. You say, these glasses are near me. In English, and in a lot of the Romance languages, the idea of the personal pronoun is everything. It's endemic to the whole language. And therefore, for us, capitalism is the logical outgrowth of language. For communism and other languages of that nature, socialism or communism is the natural outgrowth of that language. It's that thought process that is defined by the language. Am I communicating?
So you learn a way of thinking by the language that you...
Right. You learn a way of thinking by the language. And you learn value systems by the language.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot, just teaching Johnny to read, you know, helping him with his reading and stuff, and how, you know, it's really weird. I mean, you really start getting on that elemental level of seeing how these things, you know, going right into his little brain, you know, jumping off the page, you know, and it's, you know, there's nothing else to do. You know, you teach him another language or something. But it's just wild. Yeah, become a communist.
We were talking about it the other night. It occurred to me that, you know, Hitler, that was the ultimate experiment. He changed the form of the language so that he could, it was easier for him to control the siblings.
I don't know about that. I mean, I'm taking, but I just don't know. I don't know that that's... But in Genesis 11, it said, the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and there they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to and let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they all have one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Now, in the scriptures, language is obviously intimately related to your thinking. And language is obviously intimately related to the plan of God. Because that which is of God was the Word, the Logos. And faith cometh by hearing what? Hearing the spoken word. And so intimately involved in the plan of God is that language being spoken. So it has to be thought first, then spoken. Thought, spoke. Thought, word. Thought, speak. And action. Now, this is something else. Harry was the point man for this the other night, so he already... Did you listen to the tape yet? Do you understand it now? Or?
I haven't listened to it yet.
All night long.
I'm avoided listening to it. Sometime in 88.
That all religion, including all of us as being religious, want the reward of the process to be isolation. We want that isolation so badly that we put spiritual phenomena on the isolation, and we want to have fellowship without words. We want to have, you want to be so intimately connected with someone that you will be, quote unquote, in tune with them without words. I mean, my desire has always been, if I could have ever found her, I probably would have gotten married, for a woman that would know me well enough where she would intuit what I wanted without me telling what I wanted.
What are you saying is wrong with that? What is that?
That's the opposite of that which God desires. God says that the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. Mm-hmm. Now, prophecy, by definition, can't be in isolation. The testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. That means that, and you know, as Ed was prophesying a little earlier, and I hit him. Well, that's the cost of it.
He says it's going to be easy, right?
It's a thankless job sometimes.
But hear me. You sit and muse great, wonderful thoughts in your heads. And you have moments of great understanding and revelation, and you're running around, you know, it's wonderful.
God's not impressed.
God doesn't give. God doesn't care.
But then you open your mouth, and it sounds dumb.
There's a question that comes up here immediately that seems like an inconsistency. And the question is, then what about the example we have used over and over and over of God wants you to do what he wants you to do without him telling you what he wants you to do?
Okay. That's the end result of him vis-a-vis the bride. The process to get there is to lay down our lives one for another. Again, most of you, what you really desire, you don't really desire God stuff. You don't want what sonship truly is. You want to be an angel. Angels have instant communication without speaking. Angels have all of the things that power and, but they are meaningless in terms of what we have. But I don't want you to be angels anymore. Though he were a son, yet he learned obedience by the things that he suffered. How did he suffer them? By opening his mouth.
You can see that.
He didn't sit there and spend his whole life thinking.
This all ties in with abandonment, doesn't it?
Man.
Because, I mean, you can't even sit there and go, this is me prophesying. Because then you're doing me stuff again, and you can't sit there and go, well, I'm not going to say this because it's judgmental, and all that.
Well, I shouldn't be thinking this, but...
Yeah. So there is no... So you've heard that God is not real, because what we're talking about now is prophesying, which is bringing forth, letting forth what is there.
Right.
And what we have always talked about in the example a minute ago is part of that process.
Right.
But...
It's the beginning of the process.
Yeah, the end of the process would be where there's no contradiction between the word and the inner reality, and then you would be on that level of fellowship where you would be like.
Yeah, you see, this is why God. one of these days we're gonna get to the study of the tabernacle. But remember. If man were going to build a tabernacle, the first thing we'd do is put up the white curtain to indicate how holy we were. And then we'd still go inward, and then finally someday we might get to build the ark and the cherubim.
That's what they do in construction projects, Yeah, they build a fence around the big hole.
And we can't look in and see what's going on.
Now, God said, no, that's not the way it goes. God says... The ark is the first thing built. Then the mercy seat. And then everything else goes outward. Now, the reason that ties in is because you don't believe that the ark is in the temple yet. So therefore you have to straighten things up, or things have to get straight before the ark's in the temple. But again, the process... the end result of all this is so that you will be able to be in a position that Christ said, whatsoever you say shall be done for you by my Father which is in heaven. Now that's the heritage that's set before you. It's your inheritance. It's your lawful right. All we're doing is taking back the ground that you have given over to the deceiver. No, he's going to fight like hell, but it doesn't matter. The warfare is accomplished. So for the next 2 days at least, be aware in your thoughts and in your words of the use of the personal pronoun. Well, some of you, that's all you know how to do. Your life is so consumed with poor me
that there is no other identity yet revealed within the vessel. It will not be as long as your identity continues to be poor me. Poor me isn't going to get better. Poor me has to go to the cross.
When you were talking about, you know, feeling bad, right? But the idea of separating me from all those, you know, the kind of like possession of, I feel bad, and those just somehow that nick something in me.
Yeah, it'll nick the deceiver in you.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk for a minute about another area. Remember, the end result of casting down imaginations and bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, the end result of that point is that you are no longer a respecter of your thoughts. Therefore, you no longer, you're just as content in what the world would call depression as you would be in revelation. It matters not. And therein is the secret of life, the secret that Christ knew, and how you can rejoice in tribulation. And automatically, with no effort on your part, you will wake up one day and find out that every one of your heart's desires has been met. That you, all of a sudden, over a period of what seems to be a very limited time, the I motive is gone from your life. Positive or negative. Without you having done anything. Except to see. Now, the reason this is so vital is, again, this process that we're about, that it's the Jubilee year. All the land has been given back to its rightful owner. And there's some usurpers on the land that are still there. Part of that, one of those usurpers is, oh, I want to understand. Another usurper is, oh, I want revelation. And as long as you give any part of the land and allow any part of the land to remain in the usurper's hold, he will not stay still. He will expand his holdings. Now, this will fly in the face of everything that you know in your heart, in your mind. But it goes back to the finished work of Christ. You no longer have the right to say or to respect whether a thought is good or bad or indifferent.
Whether your thoughts are good or bad or different, or whether a thought.
Now I'm causing you, for the purpose of discussion, for the purpose of understanding, I'm causing you to look at yourself for a brief period of time. So you can see the deceiver more clearly.
What's the difference between, she said, a thought or your thought? What's the difference?
Well, she was respecting Doug's thought.
I was pointing at John, but anyway, if John has a thought, I mean...
How would you know what it was? Did you think about it?
I guess there's between exhortation and this other stuff. I mean...
What?
Well, what does it mean to exhort? does it mean to say?
To exhort means to say whatever is necessary at the process of the child, the adolescent, the young man, or the father. You don't exhort little Johnny the same way you exhort big Johnny.
Amen.
Of course.
Okay, well, you can't, so therefore there's no rule for exhorting. The end result of the only exhorting is, that's why the only exhorting that's ever valid in the over long periods of time, that's why Paul said, I am determined to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. I glory in nothing but the cross. The cross is the only constant, but its understanding and depth is revealed . So, I mean, there's no rule of, well, this is how I should exhort somebody. But all I'm asking you to do is for the next 2 days is to be aware. I'm not actually doing anything about it. I'm asking you to be aware of how totally consumed you are by the deceiver. And the deceiver is simply the I motive. Does everybody understand that?
Yes.
Okay, let's go to Isaiah. No, everybody have a Bible. Never mind. Let's take a break. The reason we're going to do this is because we're going to have the November. There's too many people born in November. We've got to do something about that.
kill them.
I'll change.
Take it, big guy.